tune in Wednesdays for an afternoon of jazz. Hosts of Jazz Lives, A Jazz World, and Jazz in the Afternoon play the very best in jazz music. From the historical to the present, and jazz of all stripes, swinging, smoking, bluesy, funky, new and old, but all good. That's Wednesday afternoons from noon to 4 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next at 11, Stephanie Potter hosts The Recovery Zone. Her guest is author and poet Martin Prechtel, who talks about his new book, The Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia, information at 503-232-HOPS, H-O-P-S, or hopworksbeer.com. And also by The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW, G-R-O-W. And now we go to Stephanie Potter with Recovery Zone.
Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter. This is The Recovery Zone, and it's a show basically focused on healing our world. My guest today is here to talk about how the role of grief in healing our world, and his name is Martin Prechtel. He's a Native American Indian, or half-blood, I guess, and he's also was a shaman in New Mexico, Guatemala. He was raised here, though, in New Mexico, in a Pueblo village. He had to leave during the Guatemalan War. There was a lot of people being killed, and his life was at risk. He fled with his family and came back. And he now lives again in New Mexico and teaches at the Bolad's Kitchen. It's his school. He's not only a writer, he's a painter, a musician, a teacher, and I guess still a shaman. And we do have you on the phone, right, Martin?
You bet.
Great, okay. I guess I'd like to start this show. The book, again, is called The Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise. And could you just tell us, like, what brought you to write that as its title?
Well, that's the whole point of the book. It's basically explained in the last chapter, which is a mini chapter.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for having me on your show. But the smell of rain on dust is actually anybody who's lived in a place where there's no rain for a long time knows that the smell of rain on dust is the most divine thing you could ever experience. Every mammal, every reptile, every human, the land itself, everything just goes totally ecstatic when finally the smell of the beautiful rain hitting the beautiful dust. So that's one reason. The other reason is that when I lived in Guatemala and Santiago Titlán with the Tutu Hillmai people there, I was part of the clans there, and they do everything in couplets. All of their spirituality is in couplets, actually, and so they don't have like a one deity. Everything goes in twos. So there's always a male and always a female. And there's two terms. One is called Rosumsehil, and the other one is called Pukhil. And Sumsehil means the smell of corn or any sort of grain being toasted by cheerful women in the early mornings. And then Pukhil means the smell of rain on dust. So those two together, the force field between the smell of beautiful food being prepared by people is considered to be peace, total peace, in a place where it's hard to make a living, you know. And then the smell of rain and dust means there will be more plants, there will be more people, more children, everything will be, we'll be okay. So the smell of rain and dust was just an obvious thing for the grief and praise because of the idea of the modern world being as dry as dust when it comes to spiritual and emotional relationship with the ground. And that, you know, weeping when the tears finally hit the dust, maybe life can come back. So I call it smell of rain and dust. I mean, the marketing people didn't want it, but I stuck to it. It turned out to be really popular, so that's fine with me.
Yeah, it works. It works a lot. And, I also want to let people know that you're going to actually be here in Portland July 1st. You'll be speaking at the Central Lutheran Church. That's at 1820 Northeast 21st Street. And you're also going to be in Oregon June 26th in Ashland, and Eugene Tuesday, June 23rd, speaking at a couple of places there. And I guess your website is, people could find out more at your website?
Sure.
Flowering Mountain.
Flowering Mountain.com, yeah.
Great.
I don't use computers, so I'm just saying, what is it? Yeah, FloweringMountain.com would be great, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to sort of get a little bit about your childhood before we got really into the smell of rain and grief on dust, because you grew up different than most Americans.
Well, I don't know. Actually, I grew up in New Mexico.
You know,
and a lot of people think New Mexico is part of the United States, but we're still waiting for the United States to actually happen. So, you know, northern New Mexico is different than southern New Mexico. And up there, we have 19 pueblos. Most of them don't like being in the news, so they're very quiet about who they are. They're a lot different than a lot of Native American peoples in this country in the sense of what their destiny has been. So the village I grew up in is fairly large and extremely old-fashioned. But I'm not a member of that tribe. My mother's nativeness and my father's nativeness, actually my mother's comes from Canada, and then my father was in the Quarter Lenape, but my mother got a job on this particular Indian land teaching young people English, and as a school teacher. So I grew up with all the kids there, you know. So I grew up, well, I tried to grow up anyway, you know, in a very open land, very wild, you know, desert. I guess most people, you guys would call it a desert. We think it's quite lush, but, and then they have very much a ceremonial respect for the land. And unfortunately, I grew up underneath the always every night when we go to sleep, we could see Los Alamos, you know, where they invent the atom bomb, above us, you know, about 50 miles over there to the west. And so growing up there was, I didn't know how special it was. I mean, there was not a material wealth, but it was an enormous, enormous cultural and spiritual wealth. So I grew up speaking Karis language, the native tongue in a particular group of people. There's 7 villages that speak Karis. I speak Northern dialect. And then in New Mexico at the time, you know, in the 50s and 60s, this was, I'm 64, by the way, a couple of days ago, so it's, you know, back in the 50s and the 60s, most of the culture that was taking place there was not in English. English was something you spoke when you went to Albuquerque or had to deal with, quote-unquote, so-called outsider. But people spoke Spanish as well, and so Spanish was the language of everyday use outside village, and then Karis inside the village. And then, of course, most of the people could communicate in different kinds of Athabascan tongues, you know, Navajo and Apache and Tewa and so on and so forth. So I grew up speaking those languages, which has a totally different way of feeling and thinking than most European languages.
Right. I remember, part of your book, you mentioned how there's no word for to be in the Karis language.
Not that there's no word for to be. There's no need for the verb to be, which is actually kind of a psychic cruise missile in Romance languages. There's a lot of languages in the world that don't have the verb to be, but the version of not having the verb to be among a lot of Pueblo people is not that they're missing a word, but that they have a lot of words that the verb to be obviates by its use. So that's a very large subject. It's part of my school, actually. But the thing about speaking and seeing the world in a way that is positive, you know, that things like the wheel cannot be invented without the verb to be. It was invented by Indo-European people in Central Asia a long time ago. And so all of this always constant forward motion, constant forward motion is a verb to be conundrum. So when you grow up in a place where there's not use of verb to be, it's not that they're missing it. It's just that in their language, everything is described. So like, for instance, in Mayan even, it's the same thing. It's typically in Maya. If someone says to you, would you like a cup of coffee, you know, you can't say yes, you can't say no, or you can't say this is a cat or this is a man. What you do is you have catness, this animal possesses. everything has a much more courteous response. And you know that from the time you're a small child. So when you're speaking, it's not like a lack. It's actually a gain. And so a lot of people who speak English think I'm saying that, oh, they're missing this. They're not missing anything. They're way ahead. And so that way of seeing the world is totally, totally different.
Well, yeah, it sounded like when I was reading it that you don't stamp things with a kind of a permanence the way English tends to do. It's like there's a continual sense of things changing. And
They're always motion.
Yeah.
Everything's liquid, very liquid. And it creates a very liquid mentality. And I tried to subvert the English language in all my books. And like The Smell of Rain on Boss is the most recent book. And it's a very small book, and it actually has a couple of short sentences, which everyone's always laughing about because some other books have these enormous sentences. But it's because when you're speaking in different native tongues, you don't actually, it's not really written language, and so when you speak, it's not really punctuated. It has all of these agglutinative add-ons, and so the subject of whatever you're saying may be the last word in the sentence, which means you have to go and say again. And modern world doesn't like that because they're so scared and they're so running. They always have been there, done that. I got to get out of here. I got to get where I'm going. But of course, it's going nowhere. And instead of saying, well, let me hear that again. So like when any Indians are going to talk to you in these tongues, they always say whatever they're going to say two or three or four times. And, you know, a lot of outsiders over the years, you can read all these, dockets from, in the 19th century and the early 20th century complaining about why Indians go over and over and on, including me. And Irish people do that as well. And so, it's more human and more beautiful, and that's just a more natural.
Yeah, repeat yourself.
Yeah, when you repeat it differently.
Uh-huh.
So that you get like a snapshot from different sides.
Right, all the different flavors of it.
Different angles.
Yeah. And then it seemed to me that the other really important aspect of the way you grew up is that you grew up in a village, and this quality of the changingness of things and the sense of community in your village was just hugely important. And that has a lot to do with why, I guess, how to grieve properly. And I wish you could just sort of talk about that.
Not so much about properly, but grieving, period.
Grieving,
Well, the thing is, in village, I grew up in village circumstance. You're correct there. But I also live in village circumstance in Atitlan, Guatemala.
In Guatemala, right.
The shock of coming back after, my whole childhood and then my early adulthood, and then not living in village, this is what created the grief and praise phenomena, because I really actually didn't recognize grief as being a phenomena that was missing so much from Euro-American culture or any others that are more so-called, quote-unquote civilized, until I came back, and then it was just shocking, to see it really forceful, because I didn't really notice it that heavily until I came back. But point is that when you're in a village, it's got its bad side too. Everybody knows what color your pee is before you drank the water, and they got an opinion about it. So it's like you're surrounded by people who, all the time. You know how everybody snores, what they're doing. That's just, so there's that. So privacy is, forget it. They don't exist. You want to be private, you got to go to a big city, where nobody knows you. But village has a wonderful thing, is that no matter, it has nothing to do with everybody liking each other or anything. It has to do with the fact that you belong there. Whether anybody likes you or they don't like you, you're part of the you might call the ecosystem of the human psyche of the village. Whether you're up one day or down, there's nobody doesn't think you shouldn't be there. So that is an enormous, enormous comfort. So grieving, when it comes time to grieve, which always all people have, there's some, the book covers a lot of it, but not all of it, of course. There's this thing and that thing, and this person dies or this happens, or a huge amount of people are grieving because some big, terrible thing has happened. And in that case, you're going to be acting or being, you're not acting at all. You're going to be different for that period of the next few months. You're not going to be the same old Jolly Martin. You're going to be a person that's bellowing in the street and weeping at the drop of a pin. And no one's going to say, oh, there's something wrong with this guy. Oh, he's going through something. We have to do. No, they're going to say, let's help him do it. let's throw in with him. It's not like they're looking at you and say, oh, no, he better get some drugs or something. It's like, no, let's be part of that. And so it's very different, you know, it's very different. And it's a terrible shock to be in a place where it's not like that.
Yeah.
So I'm telling you.
I'm thinking like my own dad, my sister died about 15 years ago. A pickup truck hit her when she was walking. I don't think he cried, really. I mean, I don't remember actually ever seeing him cry. And 2 years later, he was diagnosed with cancer,
you know, and
it killed him.
Yeah.
And
well, grief will kill you. Well, grief doesn't kill. Grief heals. But the loss will kill you if it's not grieved.
Yeah, I was really feeling that about that, you know. And there's also this sense, I guess, the way, you know, we tend to grieve more, quote, you know, normal grieving here is, you know, you go to a memorial and... But it's not the way you are describing it, where you just go nuts for like weeks or who knows how long.
And no, it's actually not nuts. That's the value judgment of the West.
Okay, there you go again.
They're not going nuts. They're actually going sane for a couple of weeks. You know, and the rest of the time they've got this brittle, you know, I'm going to win this hard edge, you know, success, jumping, blah, blah, blah. And, well, you know, I'm not going to point finger too much because being a human being is tough no matter where you grow up. But
yeah.
Let's put it this way. Grieving is... The point of the book isn't grief, actually. That's the funny point of it.
Right.
Everyone thought it was grief. The point of it is praise. Because in all these native societies I live in and still do, in one sense, is that grief goes right with praise. In other words, if you're not able to praise, and I'm talking about sincerely, not some sort of advertising nonsense, or, you know, telling somebody how beautiful their dress is, which is great, too, in order to get more work out of them. But the actual depth of praise always has to contain grief. And anybody who cannot praise is definitely going to have problem with grieving. So a parent that cannot praise the child or cannot praise the surroundings, can't praise the land, can't praise the holy and the sea, they're going to have a hell of a time when it comes time to having to grieve. Because when it comes to grieving, grief is basically a form of praise for that which you have lost in order to show how much you love this person or this country that you lost or whatever it is you're grieving, you see what I'm saying? So the point is praise. That's what really got me, is the incapacity to praise and everybody looking at it as if it's a back burner event because it doesn't make any cash, you see. So the grief in itself, all these psychologists talking about grief, I mean, there's thousands of books on grief, but there's hardly any book that I ever saw on grief as a form of praise. So that's what the book's about.
Right. I want to let listeners know again, I'm on the phone with Martine Prechtel, the author of The Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise. And also to let you know that he'll be in Portland Wednesday, July 1st, to speak at the Central Lutheran Church at 1820 Northeast 21st. That'll be at 7 p.m. And you can find out more at his website, floweringmountain.com. And I'd like to talk more about that, like this idea that you really are missing something when you're grieving, and you're missing something that you really enjoyed having in your life, you know, that there was a lot of, as you say, praise for.
It's not necessarily enjoy. You know, love doesn't necessarily mean you enjoy what you love, but love is a deeper thing. It doesn't bring any comfort to anyone. Love is just the deepest thing in the world. And if people can't love, of course, they're not going to be grieving, but it makes you sick if you can't love, and if you can love, it heals. I mean, it's an amazing thing. And so to be able to praise, I mean, it's such a foreign idea to most people in this culture that they're not even sure exactly what I'm talking about when I say praise until you see it actually in situ. And it should be a daily occurrence, you know, that you praise whatever is praiseworthy. And so that's what all shamanism is. That's what all of the native shamanisms is, the capacity to praise what is divine in its various forms, in order that the holy is fed and given nutrition. And so that people, if that's not just about praising people, it's about praising the ocean, it's about praising the sun when comes up, everything. And so grief is about praising not only the dead, but about praising the life that has been given to us and awarded to us long enough so we were able to love, in order to have loved that much, to when we lose, we feel that deep, deep, deep feeling of the loss. And therefore, then at the end of that great weeping, we end up praising life itself for having given us enough life to have loved.
Right, right. I remember myself when my sister died, there's just like this hollow feeling like in my chest that you described in your book.
Absolutely.
And also like the kind of trance-like space that you get into. It's very intense, you know.
Death is not the only one, but it's very intense. And the thing is, the problem is, and most of the, I think is what you're getting up to, is that And most village situations or tribal situations where they're intact, you know, I'm not talking about other things that where people are not intact, but where they're intact, it is a community event. I mean, when somebody is lost somebody, they're not the only one that lost that person. The whole village lost it.
Right.
You see, and so everybody is participating. So there's this general grief. I mean, so you're not alone. And then if you're a little bit more stricken by anybody else, there's people to hold you and people just take care of you until you're done. You know, and then you get back to work.
Right.
But then the thing is, everything you do is bound by the art of praise. In other words, you're going to build your houses with beauty. You're going to wear your clothes with beauty. You're going to cook with beauty. You're going to live with beauty because the stakes are so high at being a human being that your very existence is about praising life. So that when, you know, you leave this world, you know, yours a grand thing hits the ground and is feeding the world by your death, and then the others praising and grieving get you to the other world so that you don't hang around some kind of ghost, you see, aggravating the rest of the world, like is what we got with war. Because I got a big section of warfare in here, which is...
Yeah, I'd like to let listeners know, if you'd like to call in with your questions.
Okay.
The number here is 503-231-8187. You talked a lot about war and how that is a real problem for all of us, you know, as it goes on in terms of grief and in terms of how we end up suffering. Could you talk a little about that?
Well, first of all, civilization, you know, as I define it, I'm not talking about, you know, the Hmong civilization or the Cherokee civilization, but civilization as this kind of polyglot, you know, gigantic techno-oriented cyber-addicted thing, is that this is very warlike. I mean, it's based on war. All business is a form of warfare. I mean, throughout time, throughout history, and now even more than ever with all of the way communications are. So it's carried on as a war. I mean, success is a concept of war, you know, in other words, to take over a territory, to get this, and this whole baloney of, you know, the win-win-win situation, basically, you know, you're finally going to be happy with me winning. So when you have a warfare situation, it's in a constant state of emergency. So everyone gets up in the morning, get their coffee, you know,
right.
Their adrenaline glands are blasting, and eventually they crash, you know, so they get, you know, battle fatigue, as we call it. And so the killing that goes on, or the taking that goes on, the conquering that goes on, the raping that goes on, the violation that goes on, whether or not it's in a machine gun or you're in a tank turret or whether you're sitting in a corporate ladder, it's all basically the same to the soul, the human soul. So when you realize that all of the wars in the world, for the most part, are either business-oriented or are business-driven or business-endowed, then what happens is you realize in a state of emergency, you don't have time. There's no place made for grief. You know, you can't have soldiers grieving and have them out there killing people the next day. Because as soon as they grieve, it's going to go and instantly to revenge, which makes more war. It does not going to metabolize into the deep, sweet praise of life. Because if you've got soldiers, you know, are grieving the person they've killed, or grieving their nest mate who was just killed, or their own limb that just got blown off, you know, on a land device, then what's going to happen is they can't put them back in the battle because they're not going to want to kill anymore. And they're not going to follow orders. They're going to start thinking. And so in any kind of warfare situation, when there is a giant war or a small war, the soldiers themselves are given accolade for carrying out their orders, but there's no grieving for the soldier that was lost, because as soon as you kill somebody, then what happens, or, you know, try to kill, even the attempt is even worse, then what happens is a piece of your soul disappears into whatever you're attacking, and you go home without being the same person when you left. So the grief of going through that, it has to be a family thing, but the nation makes no effort toward that. So in the old days, I mean, I got a pretty good couple of sections on that in this book. The point is that even if the culture, when you and I, you know, and everybody else also woke up one day and says, okay, this just has to be grieved, there's so many centuries of this that the enormity of it can't be dealt with by small individuals. It has to be a gigantic, gradual thing over a period of years. And so what happens is, as soon as one war is finished, another war is already being plotted by the nature of the situation, because the debt, you might say, the spiritual debt of all the grief that has not been wept and not been addressed is now a gigantic hole, like a pit. And so in order to fill that hole, a new war has to be dug up in order to fill that hole. So it becomes the same paradigm as the landfill mentality. You know, you're taking this much out of the ecosystem and digging a big hole to do that. And then, of course, you invent some other crazy thing in order to fill that hole. But that made another hole that's bigger than the last one. And on we go until the whole thing collapses. So,
which is why the world is such a mess today.
Exactly. So grief is a big thing, even though it's a small thing. So I always say the individual who is doing their grief as best they can under the conditions are doing enormous, enormous help to keep the world alive. But it's not just about going around wallowing in grief at all. So I like the people to read the book because it's not talking about, you know, you're hanging around the street corner just weeping your eyes out, which, you know, there's a time for that. But people can't, because if you do that, everyone's going to think you're crazy or you're, you know, grandstanding. So it's a community thing. And a war is, I have many friends who are soldiers. You know, I grew up in a Native American societies where, you know, there's a certain amount of warriorness. But they had another way of doing it in the old days, which were very sane. And during the Vietnam era, I saw some of the guys who went with the old ways. They did all right when they came back.
Well, the villagers wouldn't let them back into the village until they...
No, they didn't let them back in. They had to make like a camp. It was basically their own little town for a while until the guys who had killed, in other words, if somebody had experienced killing an enemy, so-called enemy or some kind of fracas, they had to stay out there until they were initiated, and somebody had to readopt them from the village. Some non-combatant had to go out and they just touched the person, and then they changed both their names. And then they both became one half a person for the other person to lean on while they went through the initiation of becoming a priest that now takes care of the soul of the person they killed.
Wow.
It's so brilliant. And then they were allowed back in the village, but they were never become a normal human being like they were before, but they were extremely revered as the person they had become. Whereas the guys that had not killed are the ones that needed to be healed more because they experienced seeing it but didn't do it. And they could usually come back in and just, you know, take up where they were, get their kids, and, you know, start farming and be people again, be happy. So
yeah.
I thought it was so amazing. I learned it from these old guys. I never saw it so much myself because I've been in a lot of war, but I've never been combatant. So.
And then, like you say, when it's something like what went on in Guatemala, so many people are being killed. There's no way to heal that way.
You can't take time. You just can't take the time, or you'll be dead. You know, you show up at the graveyard, then the soldiers are there waiting to mow you down because you're a relative of the person they killed. So you can't even go.
Right.
You know, you can read some of my other books. You can get a better hang of that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Guatemala is the least of it. I mean, the rest of the world, my God, you know, Guatemala was fantastically amazing compared to what's going on in some parts of the world at this very moment. So.
Yeah, but I think it's beautiful that the people, that you really acknowledge it, that something huge happened when you killed somebody. And that,
yeah. Or even intend to. That's even worse.
Right.
Yeah, that's because you're an inextricably forever and eternity entangled with the person which you tangle with. And so then you become almost like blood relatives. You know, ancient people, ancient Indo-European nomads and stuff, they were so knowledgeable about that they actually named all their children after the person they killed. Because they believed that the woman was then impregnated by whoever you killed, and that spirit of that person became your children reincarnated. I mean, that's, you know, nowadays people go, whoa, that's too strange. But that's where original Tibetan reincarnation comes from. And so they actually, you inherit the spirit of your so-called enemy. So the idea of an enemy is not the same today as it used to be. Nowadays, it's all business orientation, man. You know, those are the bad guys. And if they just listen to what we want in this world, then everything's going to be all right. It's all nonsense, you know. It's not what it is.
Yeah, and it's really dehumanizing. And there, part of this, though, too, is this idea of revenge and taking that revenge and also turning that into something beautiful was...
Well, that's very rare to see that happen, but I have seen it. You know, I give a small example. I was actually just there a couple of days ago under that street lamp, remembering that I had a little book signing down the road from where that sword fight took place.
Yeah, could you maybe tell the story of that story? Let me just quick hit with, let people know that I'm talking to Martine Prechtel. He's written a book called The Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise, and it's a book basically about healing through grief and praise, which are actually the flip side of each other. As you read the book, it really makes sense. But anyway, this story was beautiful, of the two young men who jumped out of the van.
That's crazy. Well, to preface that a little bit, the beginning of it would be that, and where I used to live in Guatemala, everybody knows that, like, for instance, they blow up the Twin Towers, all of a sudden everyone's saying, let's kill every Muslim in the world. Okay, well, that's, you know, somebody's going to feel those thoughts or going to say that inexpert, amateurish nonsense, you know, which is ridiculous. It's not at all to the point. But, you know, in a village where things are together, they let everybody say all that. They say all they want, but no one's going to put it into, you know, national policy or tribal policy. They just let them say it until they finally break down into the grief of what it is, because where they are, they're just so sad and angry. And the first thing your grief wants to do is blame the doctor in the hospital where your mother died, or blame the truck company that, you know, they killed so-and-so. And, you know, it's very natural. You know, it's natural for a human to feel that. But actually, that's not the core of it. The core of it is life that we live, that we love so much, is the thing that takes our life. Life itself takes life. And in the end, you have to praise life. And if you have enough old people around who know this, they stay with you for days and months until it breaks down into its primal particles. And so I was always knowing that revenge, it was a natural human, you know, impetus, but it should never be made into the public policy, and so there should be people that know it. So one day I was, you know, I'd been teaching some of this stuff, and I'm going, my wife and I, Johanna, were just recently married, and we're in a place down here in the California coast, in Mendocino, and we're trying to find a place to eat, like at about midnight, you know, which was impossible. We never did, actually. And we, there was, in those days, this is way back, you know, what, 18 years ago, there was a street light, the only street light in front of a famous hardware store, it's called Mendoza's. And we're just getting ready to cross the street when this van, you know, screeches up under this light, the only light on the street, and spins around, you know, and smoking tires. I said, whoa, these kids there must have had a little too much, you know, and out pops these two characters with epees. And I used to fence. My mother was a great sword fencer. She taught me how to fence when I was a kid. And out turn these two guys, unarmored, you know, with these swords, and they start wailing on each other, yelling at the top of their lungs. I said, what is going on? This is amazing. And they start fighting, like, so beautifully. I couldn't, I mean, I was good at it in the old days. You know, these guys are really good. They're like 16 years old or something, I bet. I never met them. They're just, wah, bam, boom, boom, boom. And then this, all of a sudden, the front doors come up, open up, and there's these two young ladies jump out. And I said, whoa, this is what's going on now. And they're going down to the ground, and they're weeping. They're yelling for them to stop. And there's this whole racket. No police came. There was no crowd. Nobody showed up. It's just me and Hana and these guys. These four kids, and they kept going, and they just, oh my God, it was this ballet of sword fight. I mean, it's just amazing. They didn't run each other through, and you know, they got cut a little bit, but finally they were so tired, and finally they started, you know, talking about how they had been best friends, and we finally got the gist that one of the boys had been found sleeping with the other guy's girlfriend, and those were the girls over on the side, you know, and here they were fighting it out like in some old, you know, romance novel. And they were going at it, and then finally they didn't have any strength anymore, and then how much they loved one another, the two boys, how much they cared about them. They were best friends, and they'd won all the tournaments. How could they do that to each other, and blah, blah, blah. And they actually went through the whole thing till all of a sudden they were praising each other's capacity to fight and each other's beauty, and then they started weeping, and then they grabbed each other's head and started crying on each other's shoulder for a full half an hour. And I started crying, too, and so did my wife, and the ocean is crashing, you know. And then all of a sudden, you know, they bumped heads together, you know, a couple of Maoris, bonk, and they stood up and they dragged their swords off into the mist, into the dark. And the two girls, they forgot totally about the poor girls because the girls thought they were fighting over them, and of course they weren't. They were fighting over the heartbreak of having lost their best friend.
Yeah, and the sense
it was so amazing to see that even in a sense of revenge, if taken with the elegance of the ballet and the impetus itself of the young, just that God is so great to give them the relief of actually having been able to metabolize it all into grief. And that's the one thing I want to say, is with grief, it's not about getting through it, it's not about getting over it, it's not about demolishing it, it's about metabolizing it into beauty.
Yeah, yeah. You said that a lot. Like somehow this grief, if it's really, really experienced, and it has to be deeply felt, it can be a real metamorphosis or a change, you know,
yeah.
Sort of like those soldiers that changed, or
mm-hmm.
And
yeah, that's what heals the earth. I mean, without that, the world doesn't ever renew itself, because every stage of life has some grief, and some more than you need, you know. Just getting born is grief, but it turns to beauty as soon by all humans know this. I mean, this book, it's not like a radical idea, it's just radical in the present day. It's we all know by instinct that all grief is what keeps the world going, because beauty does not ride anything but a horse of grief, you know, and that grief turns to beauty and wants to turn to beauty and will turn to beauty and praise if we give it a chance. If it freezes, it turns to toxicity, it turns to sickness.
And revenge, right? And more war, et cetera.
Death, more war, and you can fund that pretty easily, you know. You can't fund grief.
There was another really interesting part of your book, sort of like that. Also, to let listeners know, if you want to call in and talk to Martine, it's 503-231-8187. And basically, it goes back to this idea of a society that's based on extraction, and how extraction and grief are kind of interconnected, too. You talk about, you had another little story about Little Weezak and Big Thunder.
Yeah, I'm right there, exactly where that story was told to me. I'm only, I think, less than 200 yards where the phone is right now from where that story happened. Actually, right here on the coast here by Trinidad. It was very amazing.
And you talked about how money actually swallows the world. And
yeah, it's an amazing story. This old guy told it to me. It was a Yurok story from native people on this coast. Unbelievable. Didn't tell him. I'm not going to tell that on the air. I want the people to read it.
Right.
But it is. I'm so glad you like. You're probably the only person in the United States that likes that.
Well,
I'm so
sweet.
Glad to be here. Thank you so much for reading it. That's great. Yeah, I've, you know, this book is already in fourth printing as of yesterday. It's only been out for almost 2 months. And everybody's reading everything but that chapter. Everybody's going, well, I'll go to the next one.
Well, I think what I liked about it, it's like you talked about how grief, it wasn't a long time ago, actually, grief like a feeling of sadness. It was a sense of having a grief done to us, something bad or hard done to us.
Yeah, that legal description.
And that in a way, our extraction culture is, you know, putting grief onto the world.
Exporting loss onto the world and refuses to grieve.
Yeah, and to pay that debt back. Another big part of your book for me was about animals and how...
Oh, yeah.
And how actually they are huge for helping us get through, you call them, quote, doctors for loss.
Yeah.
And I was hoping you could talk a little about that.
Well, animals, you know, that's one thing you have to say. People love their animals, you know. And I don't think humans could have survived even a minute without animals. I love animals, and a lot of people love animals. But most animals suffer pretty heavily for having the friendship with humans. Where humans are incapable of, for whatever their background may be, or cultural background may be, their incapability of grieving is reflecting the animals, because animals are generally being extracted from nature, just like gold and wood and everything else from the ground, and taken in, and bred down to being something that's user-friendly for human beings. In other words, most people don't have the capacity to be in the wild, and therefore they want a little piece of the wild in their house. And so they get, you know, a teacup chihuahua. But the little animal themselves are all very brave. And what they tend to do is take, whenever there's a grief situation for a human being, they will take all that loss and try to metabolize it. And some of those animals are so good they can do it. But most of them start to get the sickness that the human would normally get from not being able to grieve. And then they usually die from it, and it gets diagnosed by all kinds of different things by vets. But nonetheless, the person goes free. And another thing is that a lot of people love their animals to such a great degree that their capacity to grieve like a human, that when they, like you were talking about your sister and so on and so forth, maybe not they can, but when their animal dies, oh, a lot of times they can really feel it. And, you know, it just, and that's when it busts loose. Their heart opens and something great happens. And so, you know, you lose your beautiful old dog or cat or whatever it is, or your old horse, and you know, I raised little horses, and oh man, you know, then you're there, man, you're on the ground weeping because you can just feel it, and then all the grief of everything caves into you, and then that great dance of being able to praise the world and having loved and is there. But the animals, you know, I mean, they're one of the most what you might say, I don't want to call useful, because to me, animals are bigger than that. I don't think of them as a technique or a tool, but living beings just like myself or anybody else. So, animals are there.
Well, connected,
I mean, that's the most popular chapter, you know, everyone likes that. So.
The animal chapter. We do have a caller, Prajna?
Yes?
Yeah, would you like to just ask your question?
Yes, I would. Hi, Martine.
Hello.
Hello. First, I want to say how amazing your books are. My daughter has all your books.
Thank you.
And I, she was in the middle of reading this book, The Smell of Rain on Dust, and I had to take it from her.
Uh-oh.
Because it's so good. It is so good.
And, well, I'll have to get you a copy.
Well, she said now what she's going to let me have this one because she's going to go to one of your book signings and have you sign one for her.
What's her name?
Her name is Autumn.
Okay, I'll remember Autumn. When I see her. Yeah, very good thing.
Yeah, yes. Well, I want to ask you about is I teach a course and we do something called Life in Review. But there's a lot of grieving that happens. And when I read your book, it was just so helpful and I read parts of it to my group. And what I wanted to ask you about is the part about rape, when a woman or a man is raped.
Violated, yeah.
You speak about inheriting the spirit of the enemy. Now, would you go through a similar kind of a ritual as you speak about people who have lost, a loved one?
Yes.
How would you treat that in the way that you're speaking about it?
Well, the thing is with rape, it's the same thing as a suicide. In other words, it's a violence, but it becomes internalized. And so what happens is you end up with a spirit that doesn't belong to you living inside your body. The Mayans, they call it shibinel. It's like to say, in English, I think the closest thing I could come up with is a fright as an entity begins to live in the body of men or women, as you say, men, but women more possibly. And so what needs to happen there, I mean, and I'm not, the end all to all things, don't get me wrong, but is that this woman then can no longer be just a regular woman anymore. She has to become some sort of spiritual healer, and that's a long initiation. And whatever is in the body there is not going to be exorcised, but has to be metabolized. In the first place, there, a little house has to be made outside the house where the spirit of whatever it is that has inhabited her goes to live, and then she can go free. But there's a lot of recipe there, which I will teach you if you want to know sometime, but not on the radio. And then the grieving that has to be done there, of course, has got to go through the stage of revenge. It's got to go there, so that revenge has got to turn into art, and made some beauty has to be made, because that's an eternal wound that somebody will have, just like the earth does the way we rape too. And you can never say, okay, well, we're going to get over this and I'll go back to being normal. No, you never go back to being normal. You go on to become extraordinary. And that's more important than trying to get back to where you were, but to get to where you need to be, you see.
Yeah. Well, I would love to learn more about this. So do you have workshops that you...
He'll be in Portland.
You know, I do. I actually so tied up with the school. I have so many doggone students, who I love dearly, don't get me wrong. But I am putting the word out probably a year. When this book is done, doing its rounds, then the next year I'm going to go around doing workshops. So.
Right. And definitely you'll be in Portland July 1st at the Central Lutheran Church, 18th.
Oh, yeah, but I'm just doing book signing.
Yeah,
I'm doing
right. That's true.
No liver transplants over there, man. It's just signing books and
okay,
talking.
Just signing books. But unless we could see you.
yeah. Oh, no, we talk. I'll wrap around. But she's talking about something very serious.
Right.
I don't want to let that go small.
So. Right. An actual workshop. And then we had another caller named John. Is John still there?
Yes.
Yeah, hi, John. What would you like to say?
Well, if you could have a chance to do a dialogue with Dick Cheney,
no, look at
him, Henry Kissinger, Mr. Inhofe of Oklahoma, and Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, and any of these conservative, that all they want to do is destroy.
Right.
You don't have to use cuss words at them or anything, but how would you open up your dialogue with them?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't dialogue with them. I dialogue only with small people. I have talked to Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
I've never talked to Henry Kissinger. I was too little for that. But I talked to Cheney. He's just like what you think he is. But my dialogue isn't with those guys. Those are not the guys that are making it happen. The guys that are making it happen, you don't know their names. That's only in the small I found that's going to change anything. And people say, well, how's that going to do anything? It's the people in power. No, as long as everybody is reduced to thinking that it's power that you need in order to change things, you're always going to have either left-wing Dick Cheney's or right-wing Dick Cheney's. It's going to be on the small ground level. Okay, so I'm not dialoguing with those guys unless they want to come to my house and listen.
Okay, well, here's another question, just one more. How would you dialogue with the survivors of Charleston?
Of what?
Charleston, South Carolina. Yeah.
The nine that were killed in the church?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, if they would come to you.
You're very much into dialogue. What I'm into is having that not happen.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, but I would definitely, if they came over, we would dialogue, but we wouldn't make that a public spectacle. I don't dialogue with them. What we do is we've got to make a healing. And because what's going to happen is passively, all of the hatred that is inside the survivors of that is going to come out, and it's going to make sickness, and it's going to export violence on the rest of the world. That's the main problem. As soon as trauma is witnessed like that, then the people who have witnessed, whether they do it consciously or unconsciously, either internally they'll do it with depression or externally by exporting that depression into violent business practices on the rest of the world. So what we do is we start to metabolize the grief there through the revenge situation so that it doesn't happen, but not so that we take out the claws of it or that we defuse it in any way whatsoever, but we metabolize it into some form of beauty that makes life live so that the enemy doesn't win. I've seen all my best friends killed in 45 seconds, 19 guys, and I got a piece of lead in my chest too, but I never stopped laughing because I said, I'm not going to let the enemy, and the enemy isn't a man. The enemy isn't a culture. An enemy isn't a person. It's a syndrome that gets into people like a sickness. And as soon as you start pointing fingers, then you get the rage going, and then you mark. You know, wars are never made by people who think they're wrong, only by people who think they're right, even left, right, center, whatever. So the metabolization on the ground of the individual, that's the thing that people have to take the time with in order to make that. Because, as you say, the victims, as soon as they become victims, they become professional. And then that is only mean another bunch of violence is going to happen again. So it's terrible, terrible stuff. But, you bet.
Okay, the book is Smell of Rain?
Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise. Martine Prechtel.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much. I just want to let people know again, I'm on the phone with Martine Prechtel. This is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. Martine will be in Portland Wednesday, July 1st, to speak at the Central Lutheran Church, 1820 Northeast 21st Street at 7 p.m. It's a lot in this book, as people have just mentioned. One more thing that I was kind of very interested in that you wrote about in the book was about the sort of like, because I feel like in my own way, I've had a lot of actual people die in my life. You know, my father, sure. Good friends, da-da.
Well, if you're alive, you're gonna.
Right. And I reading your book actually had me kind of weepy, and I was thinking that maybe I haven't really, really, really done it right. And I was thinking, well, maybe I could try the thing of going to the ocean that you talked about.
Yeah.
And I was hoping you could share that with people.
Well, yeah, I mean, like I said, best thing to read the book and then we talk. But since you've read the book, we talk a little bit. The thing is, first of all, let's back up. One of the greatest things to have a tribe, not tribalists, you know, not people, you know, all the Jews, they say they're a bunch of a tribe. Okay, well, you might have some Jews that are a tribe, but it's a cultural phenomenon. But an actual tribe of people that you know. If you had that, and when it's time to grieve, they're going to hold you up. They're going to make sure you get food and you don't bang your head out on the ground and that your family's fed while you're going through it. But if you don't have that, which most modern people do not have anybody who understands this, then you have to look toward other tribe. And so that means that you have to understand the natural world is being as alive as you are. And most modern people, they talk about that, you know, even all the hip people and the New Age guys, they're all saying that ladies are with the moon goddess and all this is great, you know. But to actually know in your bones how alive the entire world is cannot be happening with the verb to be language, you see. Because this is real and this is not real. This is alive, this is not alive. But the ground and the ocean are much greater than us. We must bow before the trees. We must bow before the ocean. We must bow before the cow that we milk and ask to be adopted. So when you have this grief situation, instead of viewing, I'm trying to avoid at all costs to have this not turn into a technique, because everybody says, okay, I put A together with B,
right,
and then I extract C, but it's not exactly like that. But the ocean, if you look at the planet, it's everywhere. If you walk in any direction whatsoever, you're going to come to an ocean, all right? So it means you're basically, everyone lives on an island. And the Mayans understand that the ocean and the sky are one and the same thing. They feel they're the same thing, which in many scientific ways of thinking they are. So the ocean is the one who can listen. And so you need someone to listen. Or can I just go to a therapist? Yeah, you can go to a therapist, but why not go to what's holy? So the ocean, very much time, if you respect the ocean, and I show a little bit of a way to do it in there. There's lots of ways of going about it, but you can go to ocean, and you can you have to have somebody, I just kind of facetiously call the designated non-griever. You know, it's like you have all these people who are getting drunk, and they have the designated driver. I'm probably speaking about New Mexico more than here, but when you're in a state of grief, you're not supposed to be driving. You're not supposed to be maintaining a regular life at all. Your life should fall apart. It's supposed to fall apart. That's what grieving is. Like when you're having a baby, you're not going to, like, go to work. You have to go have a baby. You know, time is there. That's, now is the time. So you have somebody to help you who, you know, it would be great if it was a friend or somebody that liked you. And you go to the ocean, you know, if you're gifted with being close enough to go to an ocean that's not all ripped and not all full of, you know, summer cottages. It's just a long expanse of the beautiful beach. And you go there, and then you can read the book about some of the details
right.
on how to
and,
do that. But, the weeping is, if you really think about the ocean, I mean, the ocean is an amnios. It's a great amnios of placenta, but it's the same constituency of a chemical as your tears. And so you understand that your tears is adding to all of the great amnios that gives birth to the world. So you're actually helping the world by grieving. And so then after a while, you start to learn to praise, and then you start to praise ocean, and slowly but surely you come back to life, you know. So.
And the sense was, as you said, it's not a technique. It's more like a gift or an offering. But
it's
again,
a
we have a person, Francis, is on the phone.
Francis?
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Enjoying listening to your conversation, and I'm looking forward to reading this book.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to call, but then when someone called and asked about the people in Charleston,
yeah.
I just had to call and say, to me, what they, the family expressed in that courtroom is to me similar to what you're saying.
Right.
They were crying.
Right.
They were grieving, but they forgave the young man, and I sincerely believe they meant it. And one of the granddaughters of one of the pastors who was killed said, "They're not going to let hate win this."
Right.
They said, "Love is more powerful."
Absolutely.
Love wins over hate, and it was a perfect example that made me cry. And I'm one of those people who likes to be stoic and everything, and my mom always was too. But it's funny how she would say, "I wish I could just cry."
And I
realize that every time I am able to cry about something, my vision and my view of things is so much better afterwards.
Oh, absolutely.
It's amazing. But thank you for your time, and I'm going to get that book.
Thank you. I thank you for talking to us. There's a time to be stoic, too. I mean, you know, you just got sometimes people are in situations they got to survive, you know.
Yeah,
but then the martial situation got to leave, and then we got to have our grief time, you know.
Right.
So, you know, there's a time for everything. Man.
Right.
Yeah, thank you so much for that.
But I liked a lot, and maybe we could sort of talk again about grief as an offering, grief as a blessing, you know, turning it into creativity and generosity.
Yeah. Yeah, well, grief, you know, the thing about using the word grief so much is a real problem.
Praise, let's go to praise.
The idea of loss, it has to be metabolized by grief. And other people keep getting the thing is the grief is the problem. No, the grief is the medicine. And the loss, whatever that loss may be, is a vacancy. And that vacancy, life wants to fill that vacancy. It's like water. You drop a giant boulder in water and it covers up instantly. It heals itself. But the grief is always wanting to heal. If you don't allow it to heal, then it doesn't heal, and it makes this petrification inside your psyche. And so every time that memory goes close to that place, you start to feel pain, and so you take a detour around it, and so your whole life is detoured. If you detour enough, then you get depression. So what I'm actually trying to say is that if you learn how to turn not the loss so much, but let grief turn the loss into beauty in order to feed God to make a time of hope beyond your own time, then maybe something good is going to happen. And that always includes the capacity to praise God or to praise the earth or to praise the world or to praise the fact that you've gotten life enough in order to to have had a loss, which if you've lived more than 20 minutes, you have. I mean, it's life, that life is full of loss. It's a mortal thing, you know. So, yeah, the, not that, that grief is an offering, but the grief is like the rennet that makes milk into cheese so that it is digestible. It is something that turns all pain and poison into something that can make beauty in order to make more life instead of just make you feel more comfortable to get through it. Because grief in the end ends up not being a personal thing, but when it is even a personal loss, it ends up making beauty so as to feed a world much bigger than your own little world. So that's make a person feel a little bit more worthy so they don't feel so isolated. And it's, yeah, so there, it ends up being praise. All art, if it's real art, is praising something. I'm not much of a fan of the art that makes you more depressed after you see it myself. So I'm an artist, so I can say that with a little impunity. But the fact that we're always on this, what you might say, the experiment of being a human being, Martin Fractal does not know everything. This book is not all-encompassing. I simply wrote it because years and years ago I was coming up from Chicago to go to Minneapolis, St. Paul, to do a talk on gang conflict, and I stopped off at a funeral of somebody I knew, and there was absolutely no grief. There was absolutely nothing. Everyone's talking about their NASDAQ quotas and their stock market, and I began to do what I do in order to help the dead get to where they're going. And a guy, a very fancy guy dressed up in a suit, came up and slugged me as hard as he could, and almost broke a rib. And I realized how close to the surface of that grief was to the revenge and the hatred, and it was just not being expressed. So, when I did my talk, I did it on grief and praise. That's exactly what I did it on, having realized that it's probably time. And some guy accidentally recorded it in a DAT machine, one of these old guys, you know, running the sound machine, these old rockers. And somebody stole the DAT and made a copy of a tape and then started selling tapes all over the world. And somebody finally sent me one. Said, you should hear this guy. He's really good. You know, I said, yeah, but it's me. You know? And I said, well, that's great. And it's a terrible tape. You know, don't get me wrong. It was awful. It was badly mastered and all that. But I got started when everybody found out it was me. You know, they start writing me these love letters from all over the world. People from, you know, lumberjacks and postmasters and lesbian judges from Nebraska, you know. I mean, all kinds of people that I would never get to know were listening to this thing and just saying how much it helped them. So I decided to write this book later on as encouragement for people who are too shy, who think they're too alone, or don't have any wherewithal to do such a thing, to know that they're not alone.
Yeah.
And that there's a fool like me over here with this tiny little funny little book. So don't get me wrong, this is not like the grief book, not at all. This is just a little Martin Pratt to grief and praise, a hope for help. It's small, it's a pretty little book, and it doesn't cost much, and you know, not like my other books where the sentences are 5 pages long and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's and actually the book, again, it's called The Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise. And just maybe one last minute, just to sort of talk a little bit about, as a shaman, like I was also really intrigued with the idea that you're a, quote, a weeper and also a singer, and that somehow both of those are very intertwined.
Yeah, well, the shaman career that I had was something that I didn't choose. It was thrust upon me in Atitlang. But the interesting thing about in Sutuhil Mayan understanding is that, you know, the word for singing and the word for grief are the same word. There's this bish and a bishach. And when a child is born, they're considered the first cry, the first usage they use of all of us, yourself included, I'm sure. When their first little lung full of air comes out, they don't breathe with it. They yell and sing with it. And so the first cry a child makes is considered to be a song, and that song is always motivated by grief. And the grief isn't a grief only a purely of loss; it's a song of love. It's a love song to the mother who they love so much and lost a heartbeat when they get born into this world. So the people have an obligation to sing back to the child. So it was so great when little babies were born in village, the little kids would be singing back to them with their mother's heartbeat, which the midwife would give you the heartbeat, and everybody would sing this song, and then. So that the child was being born was coming into the world, instead of leaving the mother, was coming into a new aspect of being with the mother. And so and they were received. So this point of being able to have a singing artistic capacity belongs to all the people. I mean, I don't know what happens where you have only artists, you know.
Right.
Like Indians don't have artists. That's all an invention all of Anglos to sell Indian art, you know. But they have, everybody's an artist.
Right.
Everybody is an artist by nature. And humans are artists by nature. Thumbs and hands and voices and a beautiful, eloquent speech. And when that gets taken from us, oh, man, we're a sad bunch of critters. And we make problems then, you know.
So I guess we're running out of time, but I want.
Well, there's plenty of time, just not enough show.
Not enough show time. But I want to thank you for being on the show. I've been speaking. This is the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland. I've been speaking with Martine Prechtel, author of Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise, and he's written many more books. He's an artist, a writer, a shaman, a poet, a shaman, and. Lives in New Mexico and teaches there at its international school, Bolad's Kitchen. You can find out more at floweringmountain.com. And he'll be speaking in Ashland, June 26th, Tuesday, Eugene, Tuesday, June 30th, and here in Portland, Wednesday, July 1st, 7 p.m., Central Lutheran Church, 1820 Northeast 21st Avenue. So thanks again for being on the air with us, okay?
Thank you so much. All blessings.
Yeah.
All blessings.
Thank you so much.
You betcha.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, June 24th, 2015. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson. Albina Opportunities, the organization dedicated to providing funds to help underserved businesses that can't qualify for traditional bank loans, ended its capital campaign this week after realizing $1.3 million. Albina has supplied over $4 million in loans since 2008. According to the organization, these loans have helped create about 1,000 jobs.
In national news, Texas had 460 people facing death sentences in 1999, but today only 260 await the same fate. No new death sentences have been imposed this year. A decline in support for the death penalty and shortages of the lethal drugs used in executions appear to be contributing factors. In addition, a new law has resulted in the number of life without parole sentences increasing